So we are beginning 1 John 5. Bill, would you please read verses 1 to 5?
1 to 5. Okay. 1 John 5, 1 through 5, free Bible version. Whoever trusts that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and whoever loves the Father also loves his child. How do we know that we love God's children? When we love God and follow his commands. Loving God means that we follow his commands, and his commands are not hard to bear. Everyone who is born of God defeats the world. The way we gain victory and defeat the world is by trusting God. Who can defeat the world? Only those who trust in Jesus, believing he is the Son of God.
And that Son of God term for John, I believe, was brought him right back to John 14:9. Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father.
Mm-hmm. Like Father, like Son.
Mm-hmm. So does anybody struggle with the word commands or commandment?
I got to ask that question.
I will say, in isolation, yes. When I take, because it always triggers, when I hear the command or commandment language in isolation, it triggers me to the 10 and particularly 1. However, when I read John in the first John, God is love. His command is love God and you will love your fellow man. It's sort of how I read it. And that's also in the letter in the Gospel of John as well. His command is simple. It's what you've heard before, love.
Is it appropriate to apply the same logic that I use for law to commands? That if I look at and ask, what is the law? It's the law of love. What is his command? A new commandment to give unto you, that you love one another. Mm-hmm. That seems to take all the sting out of this verse for me.
Yeah. I think you're both right, and you both came to that pretty much in the same direction, but slightly different wording.
I think maybe
we should ask the question, why do you think the biblical writers used the word command? Jesus used the word command, a new commandment I give to you. Why do you think he did that? Why didn't he use some different terminology that we would be more comfortable with?
I think that was certainly what his hearers were expecting.
Okay.
For me, I can't help but think about the covenantal relationship he established with Abraham and how through that, after the promise, 400 and some odd years, there came what a set of commands. You know, there was the 2, the 10, and the many. Mm-hmm. And so if he's the mediator of a new covenant, it stands to reason for my brain that he's using language that is familiar in a way that almost is turning it on its head.
Okay. I like that. I'd like to go back further. In Genesis 2, God commands the man. The word command is used. You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, or you will die. Or actually, for on the day you eat of it, you will surely die. Go to chapter 3. She misquotes those words, including, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. And the serpent says, not dying, you will die. Has God said? Mm. And the word, those first words of the serpent, has God said, are extremely important. He's questioning God's command. Mm. And what has come to me again and again is that a command is unequivocal. It means that you have a very clear statement of what you are to do. There's no ifs, buts, or maybes. Hmm. And by giving a command, you're being clear. And in my own walk with God, the one way I know his voice as distinguished from other voices, is by how clear he is. What happens with the serpent is that God's command, his word, is challenged. Has God really said, well, maybe he didn't really say that, maybe he didn't really mean that, etc. It's been challenged. Jesus comes to get the serpent off our back. And in order to do that, he has to unequivocally, clearly state what we need. And so what he does is make it clear that the law is not a legal document. It is a love document.
Well, your wording triggers me a little bit.
Well, I have to see it through the eyes of those who believe the serpent's lie. Right. They all went the legal route. How can you talk to them?
Well,
about something that they don't see is.
I mean, I agree with you. I'm just wrestling again with the word command and processing it. And I love how you say he is making it very clear. I guess I would add, for my own sake anyway, what he is making clear is a principle of reality, which to me is different than an arbitrary command.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Arbitrary command violates the whole idea of a relationship, whereas if someone tells me unequivocally, don't take another step or you're going to go over the edge of a cliff that you can't see. I like that. I need that clarity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. I don't view it as an order. And if you don't do it, I'm going to punish you, which is to me, that's what a command is. If you disobey the command, you're in big trouble. Whereas,
you're in big trouble from a arbitrary human.
Yes,
but that's not how God, when he says that in the Garden of Eden in chapter 2 of Genesis,
right?
He's not using it in that way.
And
I actually misquoted him. I said the word "or." He said, "In the day you eat of it, you will surely die." I'm trying to keep you alive.
Mm-hmm. I also looked that up, and I think it's important to include in that command that he didn't start by saying "Don't eat of that tree." He started by commanding, "Of all the trees in the garden, you may freely eat." That was part of the command.
Exactly.
If we leave that out, it sounds like he's only talking negatively.
Mm-hmm. No. He's very clear, again, mm-hmm. that every tree is for food.
And so
that's not this one.
Which makes sense that the serpent has to contradict both halves of the command.
Yes, he does.
Which I never thought about that before, but you know, God said, you may freely eat of all the trees. So the serpent starts by saying, as God said, you can't eat of any tree.
Right. He challenges God on that.
But you can eat of this tree. So he has to challenge both halves of the command,
mm-hmm.
which is really an explanation of the principle's reality. You know, the mm-hmm. principle is, I put all this food here for you. It's for you. Eat anytime you want. He didn't put a schedule up and said you can't eat between meals. You know, no stealing fruit. No, it's like you can freely eat everything. Just don't eat this one. But he's articulating the principle of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they heard it as a command like we react to the word.
Absolutely. I would absolutely agree with you on that.
And I guess that's where
we've distorted that word. That word command has been so distorted. And it's a trigger word for me for that reason. I don't know if this has any help, but I just re-triggered actually a memory when I was teaching overseas. We had a president who was quite an interesting character. He wasn't above manipulating. He wasn't above lying. And he was preparing a document whereby he was going to sell the college classes to the community. And he was going to get them. And I was his administrative assistant, which he put me in that job to keep me from doing too much evangelism. But he failed. Anyway, on the first page, he listed a price that was different than on page 40, where he had a much bigger price. And I knew which price was accurate. It was the page 40 price was the real price. But he softened it for the first page to try to hook people. Mm-hmm. So I changed it. I made them equal. He called me up and was very upset that I had made that change. And he said, I want that change back. Command. And I didn't know what else to do but to make that change. Well, he insisted that I come to the board meeting where he was presenting this, even though I had a class at that time. Told me to cancel the class and come to the board meeting. Command number two. Or maybe number three. I came to the board meeting, and here were all these men sitting around a table. And the conference, union conference president, who was chair of the board, of course, immediately, he had a background in political science. He used to teach political science at Andrews University when I was a student there. And he happened to be a good friend of mine, so I felt I could get away with what I did. But he immediately caught the problem. He said, you have one stated price here on this page, and you have another stated price that's bigger on this page, which is right. What do you do with that discrepancy? And the president said, oh, well, you know, it was late at night, and my secretary here was too tired, and she made a mistake. And I hit the roof. I said, Elder Chair, I think it was Elder Chair. I said, last night I had this change to be correct. I had this amount both places. I said, I was ordered to change it back. I take orders. I don't give them. And I saw a couple of the brethren sitting at the other end of the table look at each other and go, I was able to leave shortly after that and go back to class. But that's a case where an order is used arbitrarily, and it's used to manipulate people. And I see that as where a arbitrary model of governance and an arbitrary model of command, it leads to just that. Because it's creating its artificial reality. It is not the kind of reality that God has. Love would never cheat another person into going along with something. And this comes back to, of course, the study I've done on ancient Mesopotamia and the use of law and the use of legal issues. The legalism began not with commands. It began with contractual relationships and transactional relationships. And then it gradually came into more giving laws. Even though they didn't have the word for law, they had something of the product. What I see is happening to Adam and Eve and to us is that command has two meanings. It's a clear statement of reality that has consequences if you are violated. Or it is a legal, arbitrary command that will lead me to punish you if you violate it. And that's why it's a trigger word, because it's so much easier. Well, we were raised on the second use of that word.
So an imposed penalty versus a natural. The first way you've described it is a natural consequence. Mm-hmm. The second way is an imposed penalty. Consequence penalty.
And the artificial version is summarized in Psalms 94:20, and it's extremely relevant. That the throne of iniquity works mischief by law.
Could you look at these two commands that you're talking about from God and Jesus? Could you look at them as blessings instead of commandments? Could you look at them as blessings, just like the plagues that were given to Egypt at the time of Pharaoh? Were they plagues or were they blessings to Pharaoh?
I'm not sure how to relate to that, because I don't see the plagues as punitive.
I didn't either. It was blessings to Pharaoh.
It gave Pharaoh an opportunity.
Have a change of heart.
Yeah. I see. I was thinking more of the blessings, like the Beatitudes, and that was confusing. Yes, I think everything God does is for his creatures, not against them, even when it seems contrary to what we want.
What is the language? We went to Genesis. What is the language of Scripture that God spoke and nature obeyed?
You mean in Genesis 1?
Yeah, yeah.
God said... Not God commanded. It's okay. God said, let there be light. And there was light.
So there's a level of difference. In this way, we could say God said, love.
Mm-hmm.
But because he's talking to creatures who have Adam and Eve, we say, were in an ideal environment. And yet there was clearly, it seems like, at least to me, that the adversary had access to them at one place. Maybe he was freely roaming the earth, but in the garden, he seemed to only have access to them at one place. Mm-hmm. So in this sense, the command to freely eat of everything, don't even go near the other tree. And I like the idea of God commanding for our benefit, mm-hmm. for our good.
Right. Keep us from jumping off the cliff.
And so in John 5, in 1 John, well, even in John, this command I give you is the same level of, in one sense, it's invoking God's creativity towards us, but his compassion for us to have clarity of what is important and the promise behind it. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah. Without truth, we are the most miserable. Without the truth, we can't, we become dysfunctional. We can't operate. And so it's to our best benefit that we have truth.
So in understanding the character of God and understanding the way he uses command as a understanding of the natural reality, then we're better able to see, because easily for me, command and commandment are triggers. I'm just trying to drill it into my head how I can, because I use the imposed versus natural consequence, but I'm trying to unify these in my head.
The way that I've found best for me, and this may be my temperament, I don't know, it may not be useful to anyone else, but to get away completely from the language, from worrying about the language being the controlling influence. Language is only a vehicle, and it can be used for good or for evil. And the language is not inspired. We do not believe in verbal inspiration. So the language is human language. And for people in a human construct that is highly legal. In fact, the only relationship you can have in ancient Near East is a legal kind of relationship that you could that where you constrict another person to be bound to treat you well or suffer a penalty. I've asked my students sometimes, I may have said this before, apologize if I did. I've asked my students sometimes to tell me if they've made a covenant with their roommate. And they look at me in shock, like, what? And one time I had a student say, I have a good relationship with my roommate. I don't need a covenant.
So you said a little bit ago that it was first transactional relationships.
And then contractual.
Contractual. And what kind of relationships are there? I mean, is it just freedom and love that is not transactional? Because our experience of freedom and love comes with strings attached. I mean, it shouldn't. Cognitively, it shouldn't be.
We should go back to John 4, don't you think?
Okay.
We love because he first loved us. Is that a transactional or a contractual?
Neither. It's cause and effect.
Exactly. That's true relationship, is cause-effect. And you talk to a counselor. I wish Nancy were here with us today. She could validate this for me. But I've talked to counselors, and they will tell me that one of the first things they have to do in marriage counseling, where two human beings who have covenanted to live together with each other in peace and harmony are at each other's throats. The first thing they have to do is to try to get them to recognize that their relationship, they have to revive their relationship at the bottom line. They cannot survive merely on rules and regulations that they form for each other.
So
there has to be love.
And not simply transactions.
Not transaction.
The transactions and contracts and all of that. I mean, I learned this from you, Gene, years ago, and this has unlocked practically everything for me. And that is that one of the foundations of Satan's civilization is economics. Mm-hmm. And economics infects and undergirds everything. It undergirds the hierarchy. It undergirds the law. It saturates religion. And it is this very mindset of expectation of a return. Mm-hmm. The whole monetary system, the trading system, Ezekiel 28, 27. Lucifer invented this idea of transactional relationships. And it permeates practically every thought we have. And I think salvation is trying to get us much further out of our what we think is normal than we even begin to imagine. Because as I become aware of this, and I even see how I relate to people, and God says, you're expecting a return. Mm-hmm. That's not my kingdom. In my kingdom, Jesus articulated it, freely you have received, freely give. And what that means is you've received it without any strings attached. No expectations, no threats, no nothing. Therefore, you can freely give with no expectations of return. No, nothing. You just give it because you can.
Thank you, Floyd. That's a great restatement of what I've said, and much better than I would have said it. It seems to me everything on the list, there's three items. There's economics, kingship, and law, or contractual relationships. Every single one spawned from economics.
The balance scales.
Economics, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that balance scale is a legal symbol in our society.
It symbolizes economy. It symbolizes mm-hmm. law. Mm-hmm. And it's involved in hierarchy. It's like who's higher on the scales. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The scales is the ultimate symbol of the entirety of the whole system that Satan invented.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing Mark, and he's not speaking up, but I'm hearing Mark in my head. the idea of that what we think the problem is the solution we are looking for or comfortable with arriving at. So if I'm caught up in a, I'm bound, I'm enslaved, I'm grateful that God has set me free through the incarnation of Christ. If I fear a legal problem with God, I'm thankful for the incarnation of Jesus for taking care of my legal problem. And then I can't help but think about, was it Isaiah? When the angel God called him and he said, I'm unclean, my lips are unclean. And he touches his lips with hot coals. Mm-hmm. And the angel says, now you're purified. That each example within the biblical narrative is the idea of meeting people where they are. And so what I appreciate, what I'm trying to get to is in the context of understanding the cosmic conflict and the big picture, that I'm just reiterating that maybe I'm getting lost in my own thought. So
Well, what is the problem that we are trying to solve by the cosmic conflict model or the trust healing model? What's the problem for us?
Distrust of God.
Distrust of God.
Which leads
fear?
To death.
Fear?
You disconnect from the only source of life that exists. The absence
what about,
of life
what
is
about fear of God?
Fear comes after the distrust.
Yes.
So I would say at its very core, distrust is the problem.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Mark. But I think that we don't always go for the core first.
So distrust, we experience fear. So somebody who really fears their enslavement to sin, whatever that might be for them, finds peace in how they understand one thing. And the same, I would say, is true. If they have feared God, they can be thankful and at peace that he's taken care of their legal problem. So I guess when I think, because I was primarily at a legal construct in fear of my legal standing. Where I'm at today, I see that as a non-thing, like a nothing. And I see intimacy with God as the primary or the everything. I don't know if that makes sense. So trust or distrust is a function that interrupts my intimacy with God.
Mm-hmm. Whenever I say, okay, this is the foundation, I always have to ask myself, is that really true? I don't know if this is or not, but it occurs to me that trust or non-trust isn't even an issue until you start thinking about your own survival. Mm. So that before distrust comes a focus on the self.
I don't know that I followed you.
Well, a crisis, a survival crisis, will expose what you really trust or distrust. That's what I hear him saying.
So let's assume for a minute that I was fearful looking at my legal standing, and I'm no longer fearful of my legal standing. I'm I'm interested in how distrust disrupts my relationship. Help me understand what you said in.
Well, it was a half-formed thought, so I appreciate the I appreciate the pushback. But the more I think about it, the more I think that the distrust and the focus on self are kind of maybe two ways of describing the same thing. But the differentiation that I put out there initially was the thought that I would not need to trust or distrust anyone if I had no concern at all for my survival. So when I start looking at myself and say, wow, do I need to do something in order to survive? Does the question, do I trust or distrust somebody, arrive?
So if you look at Adam and Eve in the garden, it seems to me that the serpent highlighted the concept that something bad would happen to them if they ate the fruit of the tree. And he was trying to reassure them, you will survive this. You will even be like God. And so,
at the core of his temptation is the thought you have to look out for yourself.
Yeah. And so I see this as the serpent trying to put fear into them of God that he can then quench and be their savior from. It's the God is the bully kind of tactic. Mm-hmm. That I'm trying to save you from this abusive God.
And the abusive God is implanted by, well, God won't let you eat of any tree. You're going to starve.
Exactly. What a controlling God he is. What a stingy God he is. What an arbitrary God he is. What a controlling God he is.
So let me advocate for the devil a little bit here. In the context of a cosmic conflict and a trust healing, the devil gets a chance to advocate fear for the lack of intimacy. I can easily become self-oriented again, mm-hmm. even within, no matter what model we end up having, I guess. If I'm not right with God, I can be afraid that my intimacy is not enough. And yet that's not the truth from God's perspective.
Going back even earlier.
Okay.
As Satan decided to improve on the government of God. Apparently, what he felt was that love was not adequate. God's love was not adequate to run the universe.
God's government needed a security patch.
It needed a way to control things so that they didn't go run amok.
A deterrent.
He had a plan.
The introduction of fear is a deterrent to crime.
Yes.
Well, it's clear to me that the first and most damaging effect of touching evil is fear. Mm-hmm. That fear mm-hmm. is the secret sauce that makes evil what it is.
Exactly. And that I mentioned last week about Carol Coronaki. I finally remembered her name. Carol Coronaki's statement about Satanism. That Satanists are taught how to make people afraid so that they can control them. And that's what Satanism, that's its core, that's what it is all about. That is what Satan is all about, is fear, getting people's fear.
So where the rubber meets the road, when I am settled into the walk with God that I have, that I am loved, accepted without requirement, but open to growth, the flow out from me would be love, acceptance, without the requirement towards others, although expecting transformation is a natural occurrence of love.
But not demanding it.
Correct. Not demanding it. So I can have full peace even when I know my trust is like a mustard seed and he wants it like an oak. And I have no fear in that I don't love as I should. I haven't fully responded as I can, because I know in this space, I am safe with God. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't, okay. Mm-hmm. I now want to create that for other people.
That's, yeah. And that's why I said to the pastor's wife, I'm not afraid of God, even if I'm saved or lost, because I know I can trust him.
This, wow. That's why perfect love casts out all fear.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same as saying perfect love casts out all evil.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it said that the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. But I maybe would modify that to say the opposite of love is not hate, it's fear.
Mm-hmm. I would say that fear leads to hate. And that's when we know, that's when we know it's fruit.
Is not the principle of everything that is evil selfishness? It's all rooted in that, and it's the principle. And really what in the end determines our destination is whether we're loyal to Satan's principle or God's principle of love or unselfishness. Or Satan's principle of selfishness.
The problem is that we can't get rid of selfishness except by love.
Okay.
And so if we constantly point to selfishness as the problem and we try to overcome it, we do it all the hackneyed and bad ways that tend to put us in a legal bind.
In fact, the very act of trying to get rid of selfishness strengthens selfishness because you're doing it out of fear.
Exactly.
Well, if you focus on that, yes, that happens that way. But when you realize that it all leads to pain, misery, and sorrow, and you just want to abandon it and go toward the unselfishness, and come to love and admire Christ's character, desire to be like him, it goes that way naturally.
But again, the love of Christ is what constrains us. The love of God is what causes that to happen. If our motive is only to get away from something, we're still in a survival mode.
Mm-hmm.
The love of God has to enter our minds and our hearts in such a way that it sets us free.
What Ken was saying is why I was wondering if maybe that focus on self, which results in selfishness. That selfishness is actually more primal than fear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In our conversation about what took place in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, fear and selfishness was not in their character before the fall.
Mm-mm.
Fear and selfishness was not in their character. Therefore, there must have been a void or a vacuum in man for them to make the choice in what they did.
There wasn't a void as long as they listened to the law of love, which is I see as a spiritual, natural, moral law. I mean, to me, moral law is more cause-effect related than natural law.
I think that the void that you're talking about was not there until, I think, distrust. Mm-hmm. Distrust was what created that void you're talking about.
Yeah.
Was it put there? Could the void have been put there with free will and free choice?
Mm-mm.
No. So trust was what was in that void. When they chose to distrust, they created that void from whole cloth, all by their lonesome. The suggestion came from Lucifer, but they had to create that void by their choice to say, I'm not sure I trust God anymore.
I would like to suggest one step back. As long as they were connected to God, they were connected to love. And love filled any void that was there, and it created trust. Yes. But once they thought that God no longer loved them the way they thought he had, they lost that love and they lost their trust correspondingly.
Yeah, I would certainly buy that.
So looking at 1 John 5, whoever trusts that Jesus is the Christ is not an action for salvation. It's a recognition of restoration.
They have been born from the past tense.
And so, and whoever loves the Father also loves this child. Is this how would John be intending this? Is this a larger inclusion than simply those who know Jesus or say he's the Messiah? Is this saying something bigger or is it something else?
I see it as something bigger.
Okay.
Whoever loves someone who is a parent loves the child born to the parent. This is how we know we love the children of God. How wide is that?
And the children of God is the entirety, not just...
It's all he created.
Yeah.
All he created are his children.
And trust, now, relational...
I think that it's possible that John was thinking more in more narrowly inclusive. I think it's possible that he was. But when you look at God so loved the world that he gave his only unique son, that whoever trusts in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. It's hard to make that because he died, you know, he died for only those who accepted him, kind of like Calvinism. Or how would you state that in a all-inclusive way? To me, it's all-inclusive. Mm-hmm. And then Jesus turns around and says, love your enemies.
And Paul includes the universe.
Yeah.
Earlier in our discussion, it suddenly struck me for the first time when it says here that, maybe this is another trigger thing for me that suddenly got untriggered, actually. This is the love of God that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous. And in our discussion of commandment and the trigger and all that stuff, and it suddenly hit me that, John is, because I always read this as another command, it cannot be grievous. Well, I can't change that, right? I mean, you know, the whole idea of commandment being a burden or being a threat, or it's always, and I think what John is saying, at least to me, is, well, you will know that you're entering into a love relationship when what God says to you is a command no longer triggers you. Isn't that what he's saying? It's not triggering. That is not the same thing as grievous.
Any trigger is a burden to be borne. I think the context here in the Greek is burden. They're not burdensome.
Yeah.
They're easy to bear. You can hear them. You can relish them. You can appreciate them.
So a burdensome commandment is something, it's an obligation. I have to do it or else.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, when you come to the place where you don't feel that threat of obligation or threat of punishment or the resistance to just believing what God says and relishing it, even if your feelings don't agree, when you're finally coming to that place where that resistance and resentment are melting away, then you know that you're coming into this kind of relationship I'm talking about. At least that's what has come to me in this study.
I think that's a good way of putting it. Once we view love as obligatory, we're in the economic model.
Yes.
And we've distorted love because love is always giving. not obligate. That's not a word. Not obligating us.
You know, when I start to see God's laws, like the natural laws, where they're explanations of reality, some of them may not be very complete explanations, like the Ten Commandments are not that thorough. They cover a lot of things, but they don't really delve into the details of those things. It's a place to start if you have no clue about reality. Then we don't wrestle against natural laws. And, you know, it's not, they're not grievous. They help us understand. They help us to do things in life better. And when we start to see God's laws in those ways, it doesn't trigger us no matter how they're called out.
I was just thinking, as I read this right around, it just has those echoes of Paul and the fruit of the Spirit, that there's a natural flow. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm giving you this command for clarity, love one another. How do you do this? Verse 4, everyone who's born of God defeats the world. The way we gain victory and defeat the world is by trusting God. And it's like, well, the fruit of that trusting relationship, the fruit of that is actionable love. I mean, not love as a word or sentiment, but actionable.
The world, there are all those principles tied to economics, kingship, and contractual relationships.
So we
that's the most freeing thing.
Mm-hmm. We defeat it by exiting that mindset, isn't it?
And the only thing that can help us exit that mindset is trust. When our trust has been restored, it's because we know God is love. And His love is filling our hearts.
You know, years ago, I had a hard time even reading David says, "Oh, how I love your law." I meditated on David. I'm like, oh, man, no, I can't do that. You know, and now that I understand principles that are natural, self-enforcing, and God doesn't have to enforce anything, you know, he designed it all as an expression of love. And like, you know what? I do love studying His kind of law, and I'm really excited about it. And I'd sort of like my heart to believe what my head's learning, because this could really be like exciting.
Perfect love casts out all fear, because fear has to do with punishment.
Yes.
And those who are not perfected in love. Well, those who fear are not perfected in love. Uh-huh. That's the road we're on.
God has not given us a spirit of fear.
Mm-hmm. Wow. We did a lot in a little. It's only 4:39. I'm wondering if this is a good place to stop. We've really conquered those verses, I think, in a natural flow of things. I love how the Spirit has led this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, they say in a derogatory way, it's like preaching to the choir. Mm-hmm. But I find the choir discussing things very helpful sometimes.
As in today.
Mm-hmm. You're here.
Thank you, everyone. I really appreciate you being here. And let's thank the Holy Spirit together. Gracious Father, we thank you that you have provided us through Jesus, the Spirit of truth that guides us into all truth. We thank you that if we have seen Jesus, we have seen you. And that it is the Spirit that has taught us who you are through Jesus. Thank you for His presence here today with us. May we walk and talk with Him this week, and so that when we meet again, we can more richly see how your love transforms our lives. We thank you for this in Jesus' name. Amen.